Anyway, let me switch gears. Finally, one of the things that's actually quite in the, I guess it's sort of part of the chatter you're seeing on listservs and elsewhere right now is, Cambridge adopted in 1998 inclusionary zoning. There was a sort of a previous soft version of that, but I think it was actually in the very first edition of the Cambridge Civic Journal when I was producing it as a printed version as well as a an email distributed thing, which I haven't really done in 20 some years, but it's so much easier to just keep a website going, really. But anyway, I think the very, very first story I led was about city passing inclusionary zoning, right? And inclusionary zoning, a la 1998, was basically it was a trade. It said, okay, if you're building a project, a residential project that has 10 or more units, because of concerns about housing and affordability, the city was going to mandate that you must provide one unit. Really, well, not one unit, but if you break the minimum threshold of 10, 15% of your project would then have to be a so-called, quote, affordable, meaning, however you want to define that. And now that would be, in my view, that would be straight out of taking. A regulatory taking. So they had the wisdom back then, at least, to say, well, if we're going to mandate such a thing, then we will allow then the property developer to for every unit we mandate, they can build one more unregulated unit, right? So, so if they say, okay, 15%, so you let's say it was 20 units, then they could you'd be obliged to produce 3 units, but then they'd give you another 3, so now your project could be a 26 unit building, so that the effective percentage is a little bit less. It's more like 12% or maybe a little shy of that. And then in order to make that possible, there was a density bonus added onto the for the ground floor area. There were limitations under zoning for ground floor GFA. And so with that density bonus, then you could do the project. You would be basically no regulatory taking, at least, in principle, because you give us one, we give you one back, you make your money back, so we're good, right? But at some point, I don't know, maybe it was 6, 7 years ago, City Council in its infinitesimal wisdom decided based on the latest and greatest, what they call Nexus study, which basically is a legal requirement to justify things like this. They decided to change the required percentage from 15% with bonuses to a flat 20% with no bonuses at all. Or you could still do the bonuses in terms of building the project, but you didn't get any market units back, right? So the city just says, give us 20%, we'll just let you do it, and that's it. And by many accounts, Patrick Barrett being one person who's written a few pretty detailed analysis of this here, pretty much illustrates that this really squelched housing production pretty significantly. Now people can argue about that if they want here, but and people can fudge the numbers and in quotes say, oh, no, we've built inclusionary units, but they were actually built as part of planned unit developments and other things where it's not quite the same, right? Anyway, so Patrick put together some analysis about this, and some people took notice and approached him and said, well, we think you've got an interesting case here. And Patrick also owns property, and he may want to develop some properties as well. So now there's a lawsuit has been filed, and basically it's challenging. I mean, and by the way, the city was mandated to produce a new Nexus study within 5 years. They didn't do it. So this, and I wondered why. Is that why? Because they figured it's going to tell you that in fact 20% is too much, and you're going to have to reduce it, which would then require political people to make a hard vote, which nobody, they never want to do that. right? So in other words, if currently the inclusionary percentage is 20%, and then in order to make the program make the idea feasible again, you have to lower that to 15 or 10% just to get the housing production to get started, because construction costs have gone up. Things are not getting cheaper. That's a vote that many of those elected people would not want to take, because it would be cast as saying, oh, you're opposed to affordable housing by if you're lowering the inclusionary percentage from 20 down to 15 or 10. In fact, during the political campaign this past November, there was definitely chatter. You know, there are people like adamantly saying there shall be no reduction in the affordability requirements, even if, in fact, they've really the end result of keeping them that way was that you weren't producing any affordable units at all, at least not under the inclusionary program. I mean, I know there are these affordable housing overlay projects which have been sort of proceeding because those are basically subsidized by the Affordable Housing Trust. That's a very different sort of thing. Anyway, so there's this lawsuit. It's sort of sitting there like the elephant in the room right now. And what makes the lawsuit much more meritorious right now is that in its, again, infinitesimal wisdom, the city council, when they passed the multifamily zoning this past year, they effectively eliminated the concept of gross floor area in terms of zoning requirements. So, you know, it used to be like if you were in a residence C1 district, you could build it up to a 0.75, ratio of, you know, built land to land, built property to land area. So that's not even in the code anymore. So the whole notion about the density bonuses that would somehow be permitted to enable you to do your projects under inclusionary zoning, it doesn't even exist anymore. This was pointed out to people when they were doing the multifamily zoning, but they just kind of looked the other way. And so anyway, that actually puts a little more juice into the argument, the legal argument challenging inclusionary zoning. And for those of you who think this is all just sort of esoteric stuff, there are other places in this country and in the state, including Boston, that have inclusionary zoning laws. And this is one of those legal challenges which could, you know, even if it's defeated, you know, in the first level court, could be run up chain. And it's one of those things that could potentially find its way one day into the up to the Supreme Court. And at least with the composition of the Supreme Court as it is today, I don't think it would be, I wouldn't be particularly shocked if they basically said, nope, it's a regulatory taking, it's unconstitutional, that's the end of inclusionary zoning. So for those who are sort of, you know, saying we will not budge on this here, maybe you ought to really rethink that, because ultimately you could end up losing it all. As a side note, sure, you know, the kind of rent control legislation which is currently being pushed forward as a ballot question for later this year, is so drastic, at least I think it's pretty drastic, that that too could lead to legal challenges. And if that's those legal challenges are, you know, should it pass as a ballot question, that too can go up the courts, and you could very well see rent control as a concept in the, you know, nationally be challenged and go up to the Supreme Court, and maybe that could go away too. So, anyway, this is going to be part of the politics of this current year. By the way, you know, not to obsess on all the housing issues, but another idea that's been pushed, and I think at least one new city councilor is asking for something like a $50 million bond to produce what they call social housing. Now, I'll be straight up about this. The way I look at it, you can call things, you say affordable housing, inclusionary housing, public housing, government housing, subsidized housing, social housing, it's all the same thing. The only thing that's different are certain eligibility standards for who gets to be the beneficiaries of it, right? So, for example, if you have federally funded public housing, then there are strings attached that say, well, this is set aside for low-income people or persons with disabilities, right? One of the things about inclusionary zoning is that it didn't have those, because the funding was done private by built by private developers. There were no strings attached in terms of federal funds or anything like that. So as a result, it became a convenient utility for our housing division of the community development department, which is now its own separate department, basically to steer many of those inclusionary units toward the middle income strata, which perplexed a lot of people because they said, my goodness, you don't have to be poor to be in the inclusionary here. They're just giving this to rich people. Well, rich is, it's all relative in a place where average or average incomes are relatively high in places like Cambridge. So anyway, I'm to me, I naively, I think I would rather have all of it just sort of put under a single Cambridge Housing Authority, with different eligibility criteria all administered like that, because I think we're there's a lot of it's a bit of a shell game that goes on here where how what's a what's our percentage of in my view, by the way, and I've tried to be pretty clear about this, is that when you start breaking about 15% of all housing units are burdened, by regulation, so that they don't produce tax revenue, or at least they produce virtually none. Yet they can the residents certainly consume services. There is a question about financial sustainability when you start rising your percentage of subsidized housing. And I always kind of, through some alchemy, came to the conclusion that once you start getting beyond about 15%, you're really asking for trouble, because you're going to push all that tax burden onto other residential taxpayers, or you just have to permit a lot more commercial development, because then that produces revenue that can then be used to essentially subsidize the residential sector. So, when you say, oh, where we want more and more subsidized housing, what you're basically saying is let's soak the existing residential taxpayers, or let's commit to having more and more and more commercial properties in the city. And then that, in very recent years, has become even especially problematic, because the valuation of the commercial properties has not been soaring. It's actually been falling. Same thing's happening in Boston. So how do you make so you want to get all your tax revenue off of commercial properties? Well, then you have to jack the tax rate up 20 somewhat percent, which is kind of what happened this past year. So anyway, there are some pretty serious financial questions here, but politically, the safe space for a young progressive is to say, build more social housing. That's the progressive thing to do. And then they leave it to the more thoughtful people to have to raise the questions about how, who pays the bills, and whether this is even feasible. So anyway, so that's something that's happening here. All right, I want to do a little switcheroo here and speak to a few other things. I did a little analysis slightly here. And I'm a little bit of a math nerd about some of these things here. So I think what I want to do here is to try to do a little bit of sharing here, and to tell you a little bit about some other things. So again, for those who are interested in how the votes went for the mayoral election as well as for the school committee, I have all the scorecard is posted there. And again, I did refer make reference to the lawsuit that's currently before us, in the court system, regarding inclusionary zoning. So no need to speak more to that. But one other thing that I did here that at least I found interesting, whether you do or not, I don't know for sure. But everybody after a municipal election starts doing the handicapping afterwards, and say, well, why was the results what they were? And there are plenty of good theories, and some, I think they all probably have a little bit of validity here and there. But what I've did is I had a sneaking suspicion that what was really driving a lot of the equation were things like people in a certain age stratum were, maybe driven by questions of housing affordability, or perhaps actually, I would think even the whole bike lane thing, which was got to be the biggest funded campaign in the municipal election. The amount of money that was poured into the bike lane advocacy was actually quite stunning. Anyway, if you just sort of take a quick look, you might not notice a difference between there's not a fundamental difference in the shape and the distribution of registered voters from 2023 to 2025. And you might say, and the turnout in terms of percentages, at first glance, you might not notice much of a difference either. I mean, unless you look really, really carefully, right? But if you actually start looking at the people who actually voted in the 2023 versus 2025 election, what you'll see, I don't know if it's particularly clear that unlike years past where everything was peaked around age 65, 70, that there was a lot of younger voters were coming out to vote. And you certainly saw that in 2023. You even saw that in 2021. But that really jumped in 2025. And just to kind of highlight that, what I did is I just, essentially subtracted things off just to show what are the differences by age group. And I did it in 2 year intervals this time. And what you can see is, yeah, there were some increases of people who are much older, but far and away, the biggest effect was there was a big increases in the number of people voting who were in the 24 to 33 age range. I would, again, we can all just guess at this here, but I imagine there's a lot of young professionals who are working in Kendall Square, bicycling to and from, and they were basically voting for bike lanes and stuff because, that's something that they see as beneficial to them personally. And I don't think they particularly care about the older people who have valid concerns about bike lanes. But I did find that sort of an interesting thing. By the way, as long as I'm looking at charts and graphs and data and such like this, another thing that I always do is I keep track of the campaign and political finance. And so, for example, here, I just updated this today. I was actually a little worried that I might not be able to do this recording because I was busy doing this here. But I was just taking a look, and it's not well sorted yet. This is just alphabetically. But just to see, how the campaign chests, how much candidates began their campaigns with. This is really over a full 2 year cycle. The total receipts, total expenditures, et cetera. I did break it out and sorted it by different specifics. So far and away, the biggest number of receipts was Tim Flaherty. At like 155,000, the nearest closest to that was Mark McGovern at about 66,000, and so on. So, and over there, as I mentioned, the Cambridge Bike Safety, who were really the big promoters of bike lanes, they actually raised over $72,000 in order to fund a campaign, basically to sort of make bike lanes the be all end all issue for the city. And that affects voter turnout. So yeah, I think it had an effect. I think it's a little less interesting to see the percentage of Cambridge receipts, but certainly there are some candidates like Aisha Wilson, Denise Simmons, Louise Vendon, Mark McGovern, and certainly Tim Flaherty, who were well under 50% of their campaign contributions coming from within the city. And then there were some other candidates who were, it was overwhelmingly from Cambridge residents. So you can interpret that as you wish or not. I always take particular notice of how much money is being poured into by unions. And again, as I may have mentioned earlier, this isn't union members so much as it is the union leadership. So there is kind of an inside politics game, and it almost always is beneficial to incumbents. Though in this case, Tim Flaherty actually got the most because of a lot of, well, there's a lot of variety of reasons for that. In terms of expenditures, how much money you want to spend on a campaign. I used to hear like people say it averages out to about 25, 30,000. Tim Flaherty spent 138,000, followed a distant second was Mark McGovern at 88,000, and then and so on and so on and so on. One of the more embarrassing things to actually look at here, and I updated this based on the latest figures today, was the cost per number one vote. It's what was your total expenditures, how many number one votes, because let's face it, the number one votes are really what matters the most. So Louise Vendon just went ahead of Tim Flaherty at over $76 per number one vote. I can proudly say with my relative non-existent campaign that I spent a total of 16 cents per number one vote. So my Pyrrhic victory. Anyway, there's also some information here about unions, et cetera. I'm not going to promote the school committee finance stuff yet because their reports came in before the election, and most of the big expenditures were not even reported yet. So those are due January 20th. So after that, unless people are delinquent, I'll be able to get more information about that, and then get a more interesting take on where all the a lot of the money that was spent for the school committee. But I don't want to jump the gun on that because I think that's not particularly useful information as it stands right now. So I'm again I've sort of largely talked about political stuff here now, but I just want to say a few things that are basically going on with the actions of the Cambridge City Council. One of the biggest, well, I mean, in 2024, there were and I'm blending actually 2024 into 2025. There were actions taken like removing parking minimums, which is sort of part of the YIMBY agenda, and then the super densification, which is really what the A Better Cambridge group has been pushing. That included, I mean, people have been talking about allowing multifamily housing in all residential zones. I don't think that was controversial. But what came along with that was actually a rather dramatic increase in permissible density. Basically, they threw out the concept of density entirely and just basically says you can build, four stories as of right pretty much anywhere. You can go six stories if you include inclusionary units, though I don't know why anybody other than a large project that already was subject to inclusionary zoning would ever take. Build six stories if they could have an unencumbered four. But if you were going to build a 20-unit project, you were already under inclusionary zoning, so you might as well go higher and be able to put more. So I imagine there will be some larger projects that'll come up that'll be using some of the provisions of the new multifamily zoning. But a lot of people have concerns about it because a lot of stable blocks that where you don't have any like giant apartment buildings and stuff. Next thing Mrs. Smith next door passes away, the family sells it. Next thing there's a six-story building with virtually no setbacks in the back or the sides, and people will be really shocked by it. And I'd be shocked by it, honestly. Anyway, that was a big deal. But then, as the year went on, it was, and this process, I think, will continue into 2026. There were moves toward, it's part of a process, I suppose you can say, but I think it's a bit of a rigged game to do rezoning along some of the major corridors. Now, I was on Envision Cambridge, and what was viewed as a corridor then is not seems to have morphed a little bit, but certainly Mass Ave and Cambridge Street, at least the East Cambridge part of East Cam of Cambridge Street, were viewed as corridors, and people agreed that there should be more height on corridors. I mean, depending on the width of the street too. I mean, there are other concerns here. So anyway, when it all came down, they were basically took a vote to allow buildings as of right up to 12 stories along North Mass Ave, really from the Cambridge Common all the way out to the Arlington Line, and up to 18 stories in Porter Square. I mean, there was some conditions like This assumes that there's some commercial first floor activity in the building in order to make use of this here. But I would say that was there was controversy about that, but the votes were there to do it, and they did push that through. They simultaneous there was also a proposal for something similar along Cambridge Street, and even though the North Mass Ave vote was taken on December 22nd, so that's ordained now. The matter for Cambridge Street was tabled, and now with a change in the composition on the city council, I don't know. Does it is that going to go through now too, or is it going to get bigger, or is it going to get squashed? I don't know. I really don't know. Pending, there are also some other significant zoning proposals that have sort of been, put on the back burner. Like for example, in Central Square. People such as myself actually feel that someplace like Central Square could use more height, even if it was just building existing properties, one story buildings. Yeah, a place like Central Square, a single story building doesn't make it much sense at all. Some of us would like to see a little bit more coming up in Central Square, but the trend seems to be that it's sort of like you don't want to just allow more development. They want to go supersize everything. So what are we going to start seeing in Central Square? I propose they're going to say, well, we want to have 12 stories. I say, oh yeah, I'll see your 12 and raise you 3. I want to have 15 stories. Oh yeah, well, I'm more progressive than you are, so I want to have an 18, and we're going to demand that they all be 80% affordable, which basically means nothing would get built. And then if you couple that with this current chatter about social housing, what are we going to have, like political fights this coming year or two over whether all housing built in Central Square should all be quote affordable or social housing or subsidized housing, which honestly would just be the death of Central Square if they were to make that a mandate. But politics is politics. It doesn't necessarily yield good results. It just yields results sometimes. So anyway, that's some of the stuff that's going on here right now. I mean, there are other things as well, but I don't know that I'm necessarily going to want to sort of obsess about them all. We'll see. We'll see. I think just as a side note, I think the city manager, who has a nice long-term contract in place, they did sort of round out the year with a special meeting having to do with the evaluation, which is ma required under the charter, an evaluation of the city manager. I don't know. Will the change in the composition of the council make Yan Huang's job more secure or less secure? I don't know. I don't really know. But anyway, those are some of the things that have been happening around town. City Council meeting, the next regular meeting will be on Monday, January 12th. Then they'll be off for Martin Luther King Day the following Monday, and they'll be back later in the month. One of the roles that the mayor gets to assume is to appoint City Council committees. So I'm sure they're all arguing like, well, I would like to be head of ordinance committee, or I want to be head of this or that, and that's part of the horse trading that goes into getting the votes to be mayor. So maybe if we're lucky, we'll get a quick assignment of city council committees. I think under Denise Simmons that happened really fast. Sometimes it takes weeks. We'll see. But the thing is that though you could actually meet the ordinance committee just with a vote of a few councillors to sort of agree to do it. Generally speaking, the committees don't meet until they've been formed. So we're sort of in this little waiting game here until that actually happens. But that should happen pretty soon. Anyway, I think we'll just sort of leave it at that. I think I'll sort of try and be a little bit more regular with these programs here right now. So anyway, so until next time, this is Robert Winters speaking on January 6th, the 5th anniversary of the insurrection, here on Cambridge Inside Out, and I'll see you again soon.